You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 27th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey there, everyone.
Jay is again away this week. He is in Sweden on business, but he will be back next week, so fear not.
I'm so afeared. Why is he gone? Where is he? What is happening?
The company he works for, Thule, is based in Sweden.
Well, that's less cool.
Yeah.
But I hope he's still enjoying.
Well, apparently he's meeting with some local skeptics up there.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, Swedish skeptics. That's good.
That he would enjoy, but he does not like the idea of being away from his babies for 2 weeks.
Yeah, he's got two younglings.
I don't blame him.
One is a super youngling.
Who's going to make the Star Wars references in this week's show if Jay's not here?
I know.
Evan, it has to fall to you.
My lightsaber's on the way.
Yay!
Your updated lightsaber?
Oh, yeah, I'll have
sound effects. Oh, so cool.
Well, it's interesting, Kara, that you're getting more and more into science fiction because your What's the Word segment this week kind of has a science fiction theme.
It is true. So I was digging around online looking for a new word. And, you know, there's so many great words to choose from, but I stumbled upon this IO9 post from like 2011 by Jeff Prutcher. And he detailed a bunch of words that you think probably come from science, but are actually from science fiction. And I was blown away when I was looking at these words because, like, no way. Some of you, like, hardcore science fiction nerds, I think, are going to know this.
Yeah.
The first one is robotics.
Yeah, that's kind of a famous, every nerd knows that.
RUR? Is that from that Czech play?
No.
Oh, that's where robot came from.
That's where robot. Robotics is from Asimov.
It's from Asimov.
It's awesome.
From his story Liar from 1941. And he also named a person being a roboticist and the adjective robotic. And that's really cool because this is one of those words that actually found its way into the scientific community and is, you know, obviously used all the time.
Yeah.
Here's another good one. Genetic engineering.
Really?
That one I wouldn't have guessed.
Right?
Definitely not.
So the same year as Asimov's story with robotics in it was published, genetic engineer was coined by Jack Williamson in Dragon's Island.
I think those one of those terms that would have come about anyways if somebody hadn't used it maybe in science fiction. I think
yeah, although some other version of it, you know, genetic tweaker. genetic tinkerer.
Yeah,
genetic tinkerer
is the one I like those.
Yeah.
And then here's some fun ones. We talked about this just a few weeks ago on the show. Zero gravity and also zero G. Both of those words started in sci-fi.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Okay. I can see
putting
that.
Zero and gravity together. Who knew?
Yeah. Early. 1938 for zero gravity. And then zero G came from Arthur C. Clarke in 1952 from Islands in the Sky.
Cool.
Here's another fun one. Deep space.
Mm-hmm.
Is that weird?
No way.
Scientists didn't use that term before sci-fi. 1934. So a lot of these were really early.
Oh, it wasn't Deep Space Nine from Star Trek?
You know, 1934 Star Trek.
Yeah.
A lot of these are the kinds of sci-fi that I really identify with. I love kind of the mid-century and earlier sci-fi. Also, ion drive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that is a sci-fi term.
Mm.
And, ooh, here's a good one, pressure suit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I love this one. Actually, there's two here. The terms virus and worm used specifically with regards to computer programs both came from science fiction.
That's interesting.
Yeah, right? We really shouldn't be surprised at any of these because it just makes perfect sense. Because science fiction covers science, you know, that's yet to be, and a lot of that science comes about, you know, a lot more quickly than you think. So it just makes perfect sense.
Sure.
But I'm about to blow your mind, Bob. The number one on this countdown. Gas giant.
Oh, really? Really?
I wouldn't have guessed that.
Yeah, the first known
That's
use.
A bit of surprise, sure.
Is a story by James Blish called Solar Plexus.
I've heard of that. I always love that title, Solar Plexus.
Yep. Pretty interesting.
Solar Plexus.
So, yeah, we talk a lot about how technology is often I don't know, spearheaded through science fiction. You know, you'll see a cool gadget or a cool toy or a cool innovation in a science fiction movie, and then it'll inspire people to work on it and produce it in real life. But it's pretty interesting that, you know, these dreamers, these writers came up with terms that really described, you know, nature. They described the universe in such a good way that they found themselves into the common lexicon of scientists.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
There's another one that may could be coming about in the future, and we could think about if there's any other examples of this. What science fiction terms may become science fact in the future? But the X Prize has a tricorder prize. They're giving away money for people who develop a tricorder, which is basically a multifunctional medical diagnostic device. So I wonder if the word tricorder will become a mainstream term for that kind of device.
Of course it will. Yeah. Of course it will.
And what about like tractor beam? Like we tractor see that beam. Right now that people are working on tractor beams.
The term warp drive we've talked about sort of in a loose sense.
Warp drive?
We'll never have a reason to use that.
Originated in science
fiction. I don't know. We might have a warp drive.
Come on, we're going to warp space-time? Believe me. I'm pretty optimistic. Yeah, if we got the mass of Jupiter to play around with, sure, we can.
Or that new planet out there.
Sometimes even from fantasy, like Invisibility Cloak, right? How many times have you read about that?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's
too
true.
Many times. Anything even remotely related to invisibility. An invisibility cloak, just like in Harry Potter.
Just
like it. They got to suck people in. They got to put that in the title so that anything in popular culture that they can grab onto is like, I got it. I'm going to use this.
And it is like the oldest trick in the book. I know this working as a science journalist. Anytime that you can, I remember doing a story about simulating nature, right? With these supercomputers. And it's like every article was, are we living in the Matrix?
Oh, yeah.
Holodeck, right? Or holodeck.
Yeah.
And
which are like, two other terms which may find their way into scientific parlance.
Yeah, that's holodeck true, actually.
And the Matrix.
Sure.
Or the Velt. You remember? Yeah. Didn't they call it the Velt in that Bradbury story? That was the name of the...
You got me there.
Yeah, so there's a Ray Bradbury story that I loved called The Velt, where the kids would play in a nursery and all the walls were made out of screens, and it would transport them to like the African savannah, and then it like becomes real and they get eaten by lions. But sorry, spoiler alert.
I can't wait for that.
But it's
I can't wait for that. We're going to see that. We're so damn close to something like
really
that.
We're really close.
It's going to be so cool. Man, like, I want to be in Hawaii today on the beach. Bam, there you are.
And it doesn't even have to be holograms. Yeah. Like with high-res enough screens.
Sure.
And
like
you don't
wallpaper.
Even really need the screens. You just need the VR headset.
Well, yeah, there you go. There you go. You don't need any of the hardware with
Samsung,
VR. Yeah. Just bam, just right in your eyes.
And then if they had smell-o-vision, like you can hear the waves, you see the waves, and then it smells like the beach.
Or the orgasmatron.
Gross.
Hey, that's from a science fiction movie. Come on. What was the name of that?
Oh, it was Woody Allen.
Woody Allen, of course.
Sleeper.
Yes, good.
Yeah, I guess it's not as surprising as you think. When I first read it, I was like blown away. The gas giants one still gets
the
me.
Gas giant, because that seems like just a technical term, you know, gas
right?
giant. Yeah. Okay, well, let's go on with some news items. The first one is fascinating. I love this, right? So I love it when... You know, scientists write a dry technical article about a topic that we deal with as skeptics.
This was great.
Yeah, this is a great. So this is an article on the viability of conspiratorial beliefs, published in PLOS One, written by David Robert Grimes. And clearly he understands conspiracies and conspiracy theories. Here's from the abstract.
And science.
Let's give you the flavor of the article here. He writes, conspiratorial ideation is the tendency of individuals to believe that events and power relations are secretly manipulated by certain clandestine groups and organizations. Many of these ostensibly explanatory conjectures are non-falsifiable, lacking in evidence or demonstrably false, yet public acceptance remains high. Then he goes on in that vein. So it's just like, yeah, that's right. That's basically what your grand conspiracy theory is, but he's putting it in this technical jargon, which is cool. Now, this is the study that he did. The study is looking, it's a mathematical model it's like a failure analysis of a grand conspiracy. In other words, how long could we expect a conspiracy to last before it gets exposed from within? Now, he's only talking about exposure from within, not from without. So he's not even considering the probability that an investigative journalist will expose the conspiracy, will blow the
he's
lid
saying
off.
That, right, he's saying that some whistleblower or some loose-lipped person
exactly.
will open up.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. A whistleblower or an idiot inadvertently giving the game away, right? The hard part, of course, is coming up with numbers to represent these probabilities, but he used historical examples. Like, for example, he used the Snowden affair, right? You know, how many people needed to know about the National Security Agency, the NSA PRISM affair, and what was the probability that somebody like Edward Snowden would, you know, blow the whistle on mm-hmm. what they were doing? They were, you know, the eavesdropping on civilian internet users. He also uses the Tuskegee syphilis experiment. Are you guys familiar with this?
Oh, famous. So sad.
Yeah, it's terrible. In 1932, the U.S. Public Health Service began an observational study of African-American men who had contracted syphilis. They basically allowed them to have untreated syphilis just to see what would happen. Totally unethical, completely unethical, again, got exposed. And also, there was an FBI forensic scandal. Dr. Frederick Whitehurst wrote hundreds of letters detailing pseudoscientific nature of many of the FBI forensic tests. So again, it's a whistleblower type of event. So in order to come up with this mathematical model, he had to figure out how many people would have had to know about the conspiracy, how many people are in on it, and what is the probability of any one of those people blowing the conspiracy. So the four modern conspiracies that he analyzed were the NASA moon landing conspiracy, that climate change is a hoax, that vaccinations are really unsafe, and that there's a conspiracy to hide a known cure for cancer.
Not JFK, huh?
Nope, he didn't use JFK. But I like the four that he used.
Yeah, they're more modern, sure.
Yeah, science-based.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he tried to use the most conservative numbers he could. In other words, he assumed the upper limit of reliability of the conspirators. You know what I mean? Using like everybody is the most reliable possible given the historical examples that he analyzed.
Right. There were no Gomer piles per se in
right.
there. That, you know, who
right.
would
right.
obviously
spin lines. And then tried to use the lower limit of how many people would have to be involved. Although with these conspiracies, you still end up with a lot large numbers, which is, I think, partly why. You know, may perhaps he used these particular conspiracies. Mm. So, and he did again. You know, we often use the term conspiracy, and then people write in and say, "Are you saying there are no conspiracies? What about these historical examples, et cetera?" It's like, no. When we use the term conspiracy, what we're really talking about are grand conspiracies. There are little conspiracies, absolutely.
Petite conspiracies.
Yeah, you know, three or four people, one company, a couple of companies. You know, basically anything less than 100 people is a small conspiracy, and those are totally plausible. But when you're talking about the moon landing or a hidden cure for cancer, you're not talking about a few people. So here are his numbers. He said the peak NASA employment at 1965 was 411,000 people.
Oh, my God.
What?
That's huge.
That was the peak NASA employment in 1965.
Wow.
He says the for climate change fraud, he tallied up the American Geophysical Union, NASA, American Academy for the Advancement of Science, the Royal Society Fellows, the European Physical Society, and published climate scientists for a total of 405,000. For the vaccine conspiracy, he just used, and this is very conservative, just the employees of the CDC and the World Health Organization. I would have included, like, how about every pediatrician? You know, but anyway,
sure.
He's using just those numbers. That's 22,000 people. And a cancer cure, again, I think this is an extremely conservative number. He just used the employees of the top pharmaceutical companies, which is 714,000 people. Didn't include all the physicians and scientists who would also have to be involved. So while those are big numbers, you know, they're probably reasonable to within an order of magnitude, either tens or hundreds of thousands. And, you know, he does talk about the fact that, you know, you could try to make a case that only a few people would have to know. But I think that's why he used these conspiracies. Like anything to do with science, like anybody who looks at that data would be able to blow the lid on it if they weren't in on the conspiracy.
Mm.
Using those numbers and using the most conservative factor for like how likely it is for any individual to blow the conspiracy, gave a curve of the probability that the conspiracy would be exposed after its initiation. And for all four of those conspiracies, the probability approaches 100% within 4 years.
Oh, my God.
It's very quick, like just a handful of years, basically 4 or 5 years, you know, these conspiracies are done. Certainly not 40, 50, 60 years. He used hypothetical numbers, like even a conspiracy that has, say, 5,000 people, just 5,000, which is small given these types of grand conspiracies. And again, using the most conservative numbers for the probability that they will be exposed, you still end up with the probability getting very high within 30, 40 years. So these are not long-term sustainable conspiracies. Although he also then does another interesting analysis where he says there are different kinds of conspiracies. There are some that that would require new people to become involved in the conspiracy. You know what I mean?
That's right. Yeah.
So like any of these conspiracies, maybe not the moon landing one, but the
vaccine.
Yeah, like the vaccine one, where the original conspirators may retire or die, but new people have to take their place. So you can use that curve, and that curve, you know, over decades goes to 100%. But if you have like a one-time conspiracy where the people are not being replaced, then the probability peaks and then drops off as people die, and there are fewer and fewer people to blow the lid on the conspiracy.
Wait, I'm confused when you said that that curve keeps going and goes to 100%. What does 100% denote?
The guarantee that the conspiracy will be exposed.
Right.
Okay.
That somebody will pay.
Because there's so many. There's just so many people.
There's
involved,
just so many,
so many
people.
New people.
The law of numbers.
Yeah. So essentially put mathematical rigor to a point that we've made on the show quite often, that when conspiracies get bigger and bigger and bigger, eventually they collapse under their own weight, which is how I've always phrased it. And he's just basically saying the same thing, that as the conspiracies get bigger and bigger, the failure probability goes to unity, right? It goes to one. It just gets so high that there's no way that the conspiracy is sustainable over any long period of time. And if you use average, more average numbers rather than maximally conservative numbers for like the probability of failure, it's even a lot worse. It's like within months, you know.
I was thinking if he went to the other end of the spectrum, it would be like, yeah, this conspiracy theory would be busted in 6 days.
right. And it just becomes impossible. You know, you can't maintain the conspiracies that huge. And that's just considering internal exposure, not external, right? External would become harder and harder and harder too. And also, I think logistically, conspiracies collapse under their own weight. Even if everybody was 100% loyal, just the logistics of carrying out a massive conspiracy become too great for human beings to pull off. And which is, I always find that interesting. If you really examine conspiracy theories, these grand conspiracy theories, there's a lot of unstated major premises.
Yes.
And one of those is that the people executing the conspiracy are phenomenally competent, that they are more competent than I think any organization has ever demonstrated. They have their preternatural competence. Simultaneously, they make ridiculous mistakes, which is only discernible to the people who have exposed, who believe that they have exposed the conspiracy, true believers.
George W. Bush is the ringleader of the conspiracy that brought down the World Trade Center. I mean, George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Right. Really?
And you know, and I also think that we're perhaps downplaying a little bit the power of the outside, you know, investigations, if you will. That could be powerful because the motivation for somebody to expose the moon hoax, the vaccine hoax.
Oh, it's a Pulitzer. It's your career.
Instant fame, instantly going down in the history books. People would be so motivated to find that out.
But Bob, we know what they say when we bring up that point. Why hasn't the press exposed this? Because they're in on it.
They're part of it.
Do you think we have a free press in this country? Of course, the government runs the press. Well, then how come the other political party hasn't exposed this? Do you think that the political parties are in control of our government? There's a secret world government. The conspiracy just keeps getting deeper and deeper and deeper.
And it becomes bigger. So it becomes 10 seconds before it's 100%.
Right. It becomes unfalsifiable too, because they just special plead their way out of any objection, either of plausibility or lack of evidence or evidence against the conspiracy, it becomes this self-contained ironclad belief system, which again, you know, the author very quickly summarized in his article. So
yeah.
I thought that was very interesting that the mathematically, yeah, conspiracies don't work, these grand conspiracies.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
All right, Bob, you're going to tell us why all of the aliens are dead.
Because Sylvia Brown told us.
Hey, guys, this was a fun one. Two astrobiologists have introduced a very interesting hypothesis about extraterrestrial life. They contend that the apparent lack of ETs is due to the extreme rarity of early life stabilizing the atmosphere of a fluctuating young planet and making it a long-term safe abode for intelligent life to evolve. This idea comes from Australian National University astrobiologist Aditya Chopra and Charlie Lineweaver, and it's been published in the journal Astrobiology. Now, the hypothesis is interesting, but it rests on two assumptions. One is that for early life to survive long-term and thrive, it has to very quickly set up this feedback within the climate to maintain the stability. And the second is that this is an exceedingly rare occurrence. As they say in their paper, if life emerges on a planet, it only rarely evolves quickly enough to regulate greenhouse gases and albedo, thereby maintaining surface temperatures compatible with liquid water and habitability. Now, Dr. Chopra then takes this a step further when he says the mystery of why we haven't yet found signs of aliens may have less to do with the likelihood of the origin of life or intelligence and have more to do with the rarity of the rapid emergence of biological regulation of feedback cycles on planetary surfaces. So the idea here is that life can actually kind of have set up these feedback loops with the environment, with the atmosphere, with the climate to stabilize these planets, young planets that are often, you know, very variable, very quick to change. Just not a place that is necessarily conducive to for a long-term evolution to take place. As evidence for this contention, the authors bring up some interesting examples. They bring up Mars and Venus. Now, both planets were clearly more habitable in the past. We know that Mars had a thick atmosphere. It probably had running water. I mean, it had all these things that make it much better than it is today. And it's very possible that they could have had bacterial life 4 billion years ago. That's certainly within the realm of possibility. But after a billion years, though, one of those planets could melt lead and the other one can freeze you into a corpsicle and could make Arnold Schwarzenegger's eyeballs pop out. So they have changed, clearly. So they contend then that it's possible that early life on each of those planets, if it existed, could have died out because they did not biologically regulate the atmospheric feedback cycles quickly enough. Something that clearly happened on Earth. And that's why life exists on Earth today and why it is so habitable. So that's kind of what they're saying. I take their point about Mars and Venus, but I have to say Mars is actually not a good example because the latest evidence from MAVEN shows that Mars lost its magnetic field, it allowed the solar wind and especially intense solar flares to leach away its once thick atmosphere into space. So I doubt that there's any type of early life that could have regulated that into not happening. So that was actually, I think, a poor example. But it still kind of makes sense, especially maybe more so with Venus than with Mars. Now, some of you may be thinking that this directly relates to the famous Fermi paradox, and it does, which essentially states, where the hell are all the ETs? If, you know, extraterrestrials were so, we're all over the galaxy, our galaxy. I've seen studies where they figured out that it would only take about 200 million years for, an advanced civilization to spread significantly through the galaxy. And 200 million years, sure, that's a long time. Just our planet alone is 4 to 5 billion years old. So that's really not a long time. So where are all these ETs? Where's the evidence of this life? So the researchers regarding that, they say that, well, their hypothesis could potentially be a solution to the Fermi paradox. They call it the Gaian bottleneck hypothesis. And they even offer a way to support this hypothesis with evidence. So this was an interesting line of reasoning. Lineweaver said, one intriguing prediction of the Gaian bottleneck model is that the vast majority of fossils in the universe will be from extinct microbial life, not from multicellular species such as dinosaurs or humanoids that take billions of years to evolve. Well, yeah, of course, if that would greatly support their hypothesis, I'm sure, but it may as well be no evidence at all. I mean, how could we ever get a decent sample, you know, and look at the fossils on dozens or hundreds of extraterrestrial planets. That's just not going to happen. So yeah, there's a potential line of evidence, but we're never going to get there.
Well, once we develop warp drive, Bob.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. There you go. Good point there. So some scientists have a problem with this guy in bottleneck hypothesis. Another astronomer, for example, Milan Cherkovic does not agree with their premise. He said, in order to pass from the conclusion that planets, which are really Earth-like, are rare, to the conclusion that it's more, that it's the reason why we don't perceive advanced aliens, we need the step in which we prove that any advanced aliens must evolve in the Earth-like setting. So in other words, this hypothesis is probably way too anthropocentric. And, yeah. And I agree with him. It makes total sense. We have only one data point for what life is. For all we know, Earth-like life is anomalous and other types of life predominate in ways that have nothing to do with regulating the atmosphere. So that is a really good point. And then he makes another point, which maybe isn't quite as good. He goes on to say, I haven't seen, for instance, any remotely acceptable reason why marine life could not evolve intelligence and civilization, and marine habitats are much less susceptible to perturbations of climate than land ecosystems. All right. So that's true. That kind of makes sense if you think about it, that why would this apply to an aquatic civilization? Because they just don't have, just not same. It's not the same as life on land. But I think I kind of disagree with them. Steve, I'm interested in your take of this, because I always thought that there was a remotely acceptable reason for an advanced, aquatic civilization not happening. And I think I could describe it in one word: fire. I mean, that's, to me, that's a biggie. If you can't harness fire, you can't smelt metals, you can't do a lot of things that a civilization, as far as I could tell, maybe I'm being anthropocentric, but seems like without fire, you're gonna be very limited.
I don't know, but what about like a chemical, some sort of chemical reaction that mimics what fire can do? I'm trying to think outside of the box.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I just think if you don't have fire as we know it, and I could be wrong, but I did some research on this, and that's the classic problem with an advanced aquatic civilization, is that without being able to easily harness fire, lots of civilization flows and stems from that one gargantuan advance. And without that, that would be a big problem. So, he describes it as not remotely acceptable. And I think that is a remotely acceptable reason why aquatic civilization would have a problem. That's just,
we just have too few examples.
Yes.
I mean, we could say, you know, we have
an N of one.
But we've had aquatic life on this Earth for, you know, 600 million years, multicellular aquatic life, and they never developed any technology. And that is data. But still, the Earth is an N of one, as you say. So it's just, you know, we're just extrapolating and making guesses on based upon what makes sense. But yeah, it is. I think it's hopelessly anthropocentric until we start to get some other examples, you know. Well, Evan, we do have some somewhat sad news to report next. A friend of the skeptical movement, Marvin Minsky, has passed away.
Yeah, this was very unexpected and a shock when we all read it. And here are the basics. Marvin Minsky, mathematician, computer scientist, pioneer in the field of artificial intelligence. He died at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital on Sunday, January 24th, of a cerebral hemorrhage. He was 88 years old. Minsky, a professor emeritus at the MIT Media Lab, was a pioneering thinker and the foremost expert on the theory of artificial intelligence. His 1985 book, The Society of Mind, is considered a seminal exploration of intellectual structure and function, advancing understanding of the diversity of mechanisms interacting in intelligence and thought. Minsky's last book, The Emotion Machine, Common Sense Thinking, Artificial Intelligence, and the Future of the Human Mind, was published in 2006, and that came directly from MIT's tribute to him. Here's a few other things to know about Marvin. In 1951, he built the SNARC, S-N-A-R-C, the first neural network simulator.
Wow.
His other inventions include mechanical arms, hands, and other robotic devices, something called the confocal scanning microscope.
Ooh.
Sounds very impressive. the confocal scanning microscope, or the CSM.
Hey, that's my name.
Exactly. He invented the Muse synthesizer for musical variations.
Really?
That's cool.
That is cool.
He is a member of the NAS, the NAE, the Argentine NAS, and he has received awards. Oh, boy. The Turing Award, the MIT Killian Award, the Japan Prize, the IJCIA Research Excellence Award, the Rank Prize, and the Robert Wood Prize for Optoelectronics. Oh, and the Benjamin Franklin Medal. So he was, you know, certainly well honored by his colleagues and admirers everywhere. You know, the one of the more interesting things I read about him is that the Washington Post write-up on him, the reporter went and visited the Minsky house recently, and he shared a little bit of insight as kind of what it was like to be inside his house. And here's what he had to say. He said, "They showed me the bongos that physicist Richard Feynman liked to play when he visited."
I would have stolen them so fast.
Looming over the bongos was a 1950s vintage robot, which was literally straight out of the imagination of novelist Isaac Asimov, who was another pal of his who would drop in for the Minsky parties back in the day. There is a trapeze hanging over the middle of the room. Interesting. And to one side, there is a vintage jukebox. Their friends, the Minskys' friends, included science fiction writers Arthur C. Clarke and Robert Heinlein and filmmaker Stanley Kubrick.
Wow.
As a young son.
Oh, my God. That's like a room in heaven.
Yeah. And they also mentioned here, as a young scientist, Marvin Minsky lunched with Albert Einstein, but had a hard time understanding him because of his German accent. How cool is that? I mean, Jesus. To say that you had lunch with Einstein. Whoa. Awesome. Minsky said it was Alan Turing who brought respectability to the idea that machines could someday think. Here's what he said. He said, "There were science fiction people who made similar predictions, but no one took them seriously because their machines became intelligent by magic. Whereas Turing explained how the machines would work."
I met Marvin Minsky on one occasion.
Yeah, so did
I. Yeah, Bob, you were with me as well. I was in Boston.
I was not there, yeah.
Yeah, very fascinating. I remember, Bob, you probably remember this as well. The topic of getting frozen came up. And he's like, "Oh, yeah, it's a no-brainer. Of course you're going to get frozen. Why wouldn't you?" Right?
Oh, but do you think no-brainer, he's going frozen. To?
I don't know.
I saw nothing on it.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a brain hemorrhage kind of defeats the purpose. But
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, he was all in favor of it at the time. And, you know, we obviously also spoke about artificial intelligence. I think that our conversation was mainly about, like, hard versus soft AI.
Yeah. Also, I'll never forget, I ran into him at the urinals in the men's room. It was so special.
Hope you didn't hit him too hard. he was a CSI fellow as well, along with
Awesome, right? Awesome guy, towering intellectual, you know, in his field. Always sad when intellectuals like that, you know, die, but, you know, he was 88, so I'm happy that he lived to be 88.
It's a good run, definitely good.
Good run.
But on a side note, somewhat related, why the hell are so many people dying? What's going
that's what
on?
Happens.
No, but
it's
like,
well,
cool
life.
People. It's not just people dying. I don't. That
because
happens.
Randomness
we're getting old.
Is clumpy.
Randomness is clumpy.
I hate this type
it
of clumpiness.
In threes, doesn't? No.
But like, if a year goes by and nobody you care about dies, you don't notice that because
guys, the older we get, the more the people that we look up to will start dying.
Yeah.
True.
Like,
true.
It's just, people don't die that much when you're young. They die a lot more as you get older.
Yeah, but there's a bunch of 69-year-olds in there. And that's just too young.
All right, Kara, you're going to tell us about probiotics. Do they work or don't they work?
And really more than that, I'm going to dig deep in. I'm going to introduce you to a character who you may or may not know. You know, we hear a lot, I think, I get feedback a lot through the email exchange on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe website. And I also get feedback outside of that from people saying, who is a reputable source? Who can I listen to? What's a good place to cut through the hype? And so I'm going to kind of introduce you to somebody who you may not know named Jonathan Eisen. And just as a disclaimer, I do know Jonathan. I would say that he is in my extended social circle. We follow each other on Twitter and we've worked never together on any projects, but we have a lot of friends in common because he's pretty big in the science communication community. But I stumbled on this great article by Emma Bryce in Wired this month. So in the January issue of Wired.
Kara, before you go forward, I have to point out
that
if I were this guy, I would build my home, would be a tower, and I would call it Isengard.
Oh, my God. Wow.
pass that note along.
How could you not do that? All right, go on.
So Emma Bryson Wired this month wrote a great article highlighting the fanaticism basically that surrounds the human microbiome. I mean, think about it, guys. We talk about the microbiome a lot on the podcast.
People
bring up the microbiome a lot, but we're seeing so much pseudoscience, so much pseudojournalism, and of course, I must say, blatant agnotological claims.
Ooh.
We'll throw back there. That are made around the microbiome. And so there's this scientist named Jonathan Eisen. He's a microbiologist at UC Davis, and he has a blog called The Tree of Life. It can be found at phylogenomics.blogspot.com. And Emma Bryce basically featured Jonathan Eisen in this article to try and cut through some of this pseudoscientific bullshit out there about the microbiome. Eisen actually calls it microbiomania. He's coined a term. And he gives out fake awards every year to the worst perpetrators of microbiomania.
I like that.
Yeah, it's really great. And so I have a couple of great quotes from him because you know I love my quotes. He says, there are two ends to this. There's ridiculous stuff about why we should kill all the microbes. That's the germophobia club. And then there's microbiomania, who think that microbes are beneficial and do everything. And, you know, we see this a lot, I think, in SciComm, where there's something that's new that's on the horizon, and it seems promising in a very narrow or a very specific arena. But, of course, once we see that promise, we'll start to see practitioners of pseudoscience just spreading it everywhere. And I think the microbiome is kind of like the hot new thing. You know, we've got all this gut bacteria. We're starting to finally sequence all of our gut bacteria. If we change our gut bacteria, it could solve all of our problems. So in this article specifically, Emma talks about, oh my goodness, there are people who will claim that fecal floral reconstitution or repopulation.
Oh, yeah,
you guys
absolutely.
Have heard about this, right? Fecal transplants. Yeah, that can cure apparently schizophrenia. Not sure how that would work or what the connection would be at all, and that probiotics actually cure asthma, which of course has no support whatsoever. But this is what always happens. There'll be some anecdotal evidence or even some very strong scientific evidence supporting a very particular situation. In this case, we know that fecal floral repopulation or poop transplants are really useful in the treatment of C. diff, Clostridium difficile, which is a bad bacteria that people get in their gut. And the problem with these bad bacterial infections once you get into the intestinal region is that any antibiotics that you take to wipe it out will wipe out all of the other gut flora that kind of help keep it in check. And then you have this horrible kind of feedback loop that happens. And so we've seen really good evidence that poop transplants work for that. But now it's like, oh, will a poop transplant solve my schizophrenia? Probably not. Gosh, let me see. Here's one. Oral hygiene can determine a woman's risk of preterm birth by studying the bacteria in her mouth. We'll understand more about when a woman gives birth. And it's one of those things where an article actually came out where fetal health experts at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas showed that the gut microbacteria, or the gut bacteria, I should say, or microbiome, matched similar bacteria to what they found in mothers' mouths. Okay, this is a finding. It's an interesting finding. But then we see a lot of times in bad science reporting that then crazy claims are made based on that finding, like the bacteria in your mouth could determine whether or not your baby is healthy, when the study didn't say anything about that. So this was one of those situations where Jonathan Eisen gave one of these awards for overselling the microbiome. That's what he calls them. And he's now given many of those awards. And sometimes it's to places like the New York Times, to Time Magazine, to places that we think of as being legitimate bastions of good reporting. But, you know, nobody, I think, is immune to bad science reporting, especially when we're dealing with journalists who aren't trained in the sciences, who will find other articles that back up these claims. And sometimes it's actually the PIO or the public information office that writes the press releases from the university itself that's spreading that misinformation. So I thought this was a cool article to read. You guys should check it out on Wired this month in both the print magazine and online. It will lead you to Eisen's blog, The Tree of Life. You can read all of his Microbiomania articles. He's been doing microbiome research for 10 plus years, and it really pisses him off how people oversell it. And so it's a good way, I think, to find that balance and to understand a little bit better where the hype should be and where the hype probably shouldn't be. Oh, and by the way, to answer your question, Steve, probiotics don't cure asthma.
Yeah. Mark Crislip has done a lot of writing for Science-Based Medicine on probiotics as well, yes, and on his QuackCast, which is another good source of medical information like that. But yeah, I think probiotics is like in that perfect sweet spot where it's interesting, legitimate science, but it's fairly preliminary, and it's just perfect for exploitation.
Yeah.
You know, and I there is an industry, we call it the supplement industry, but there is an industry that their basic operating model is to look for preliminary scientific findings and then overhype them.
Yep.
That's what they do. They're just waiting, you know, for the latest thing that they could exploit to make it seem like, oh, do this and you'll live forever.
Right. People want a panacea.
Yeah,
they do. And they love the sexy new research. You know, it's like inflammation is another good example. We're starting to understand that inflammation does underlie a lot of medical problems, but we don't fully understand what role inflammation has, what the inflammatory factors are responsible for exactly. And I think that people will go off the rails with that. Just to close, I have another great quote here from Eisen that says, one of the reasons I think it's a big deal not to oversell the microbiome, and the reason I blog about this relentlessly, is that it's really complicated. Many aspects of our health are most likely affected by microbes, but most likely isn't good enough for telling people how to medicate them.
Right.
Right.
And I think that's just a great skeptical quote.
I blogged about this today on Science-Based Medicine. My favorite historical example now is antioxidants. Because antioxidants was in the 1990s where the microbiome is today in terms of where the research is and where the hype is. You know, in the 1990s, antioxidants were going to cure everything. And what prompted me to write about it again was a study showing that if you give mice with certain kinds of solid tumors like melanoma antioxidants, it increases their rate of metastasis because oxidative species are part of the immune system. They're part of how our immune system fights things cancer cells. And if you just take high doses of antioxidants, you're actually impairing some normal functions of our body, including our immune functions. It's a delicate balance, and a simplistic notion of some is good, so more is better is likely not to work out the way you intend it to.
And Kara, you mentioned sexy new products. If you go back in time, you could see some of the new crazy products that came out when electricity was the new sexy science. Or how about radiation?
radiation.
Yes. It's
like, here are your radiation pills.
Yeah.
Incredible.
They used it for everything. People took radium baths.
They sure did.
Yep.
Oops.
Crazy. All right. We're going to do one quick email this week. This is a fun one. This comes from Tim Nolan from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Tim writes, I was wondering if the skeptical community has noticed that some scammers, psychics, and similar frauds are making up fake websites where their claims are skeptically questioned but found to be completely true. I found this one when researching the medical medium Anthony William. It's even named scam in a way that people might think it is legitimate, but it is just packed with five or so articles where a possibly fake skeptic says they investigated the medical medium but found all his claims to be true. Yeah, I took a look at this page too. It's mildly entertaining as a skeptic. First of all, the author is not a skeptic at all. It's clearly bullshit. You know what I mean? So essentially what it is, it's somebody saying, oh, I'm a hard-nosed skeptic and I investigated this potential scam artist. But, you know, I found that he was really true that, you know, and then it's like, it's just like this fawning review of the psychic making every logical fallacy you can imagine. You know, clearly the person writing it has absolutely no idea about critical thinking or skeptical analysis.
That's right.
What would you guess their relationship is?
Oh, it's either the person themselves or somebody working with them.
Yeah,
absolutely. But it's just they do such a horrible job of being a fake skeptic. That's what's interesting to me. It's like they don't know enough to even pull off even a semi-reasonable impersonation of a skeptic. But you could also say it's interesting that they think that there's something to be gained by pretending to be a skeptic, analyzing it. I wonder if that says anything about the impact that we're having. Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's, yeah, it's interesting. We've actually talked about this scam previously where people selling a product have websites called This Is a Scam. You know, their product is a scam, and you click it and it goes to a page selling their product. You know, they're just using, or like there's a news report. It's a fake news report, you know, with a stock photo of a fake journalist, you know, newscaster saying that this product is a scam, but it's actually like their competitor's product. You know, if you want the true stuff, or it's a fake competitor's product that they're saying is a scam, and it's all leading you to thinking if you want the real product, then you got to go to whatever they're selling you, you know, their brand. Yeah. So the fake skepticism, but it's not convincing at all. It really, it's laughable, but I guess it works because they're doing it. I guess it doesn't have to be statistically, you know, even if it works 1% of the time, that, you know, that'll drive you traffic. You know, you'll make a living.
Yeah. And it goes to show you that still the general public doesn't exactly understand what it is to really be skeptic. It goes beyond just calling yourself a skeptic or claiming it.
Yeah.
It's a process. It's a little deeper than that.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we have a great interview coming up with the Psybabe. So let's go to that now. Well, we are being joined now by Yvette D'Entremont, or otherwise known as the Psybabe. Yvette, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you for having me.
I've been meaning to have you on for quite a while, actually. I'm glad to be hooked up this week. So you were previously known as the Science Babe, but then you rebranded yourself the Psybabe. And I don't know if it correlates with that or if you just had a renewed interest, but it definitely your presence online has exploded in the last like 6 months or so. What do you attribute that to?
Well, it started on a random Friday night. I had been posting a lot on a bunch of different skeptic blogs, and I thought maybe there's a place for me in this. And it kind of started with ribbing the Food Babe, of course, online. I had been working at a pesticide lab, and I'd seen a lot of misinformation about pesticides. I'm an analytical chemist by trade. I have a background in chemistry and forensic science. And, you know, before I started working at this pesticide lab, I, of course, you know, just like everyone seems to have been, I was a bit of a skeptic about, you know, I know I'm using the term wrong. I was a bit of a skeptic about GMOs and about Monsanto. I thought they were the devil and they were poisoning me. And then I started working at this lab and I realized they're really heavily regulated. They're hard to get onto the market. They go through a ton of research. And I kept seeing it in pop culture and all over the internet that there's no research in them. And I'm like, yes, I basically just lick the vial, say it's probably not going to kill your kids and just, you know, pass them on to the market. And, you know, I started writing it like that online and people thought it was funny. I'm like, oh, maybe I should blog about it. So, you know, I started the page kind of as a bit of a, you know, a satire to the Food Babe. And I was really shocked at how fast it started taking off. I was getting about 1,000 new followers a week, which I thought was really fast. And I hadn't done any professional writing yet. It was just a blog and I was doing about one blog entry a week. And then an editor at Gawker reached out to me and said, would you like to, you know, take a swing at the Food Babe at Gawker? And I was like, don't mind if I do. And that article took off like crazy. Oh, I mean, it got, within the first 6 hours that it was out, it got 1 million hits.
Wow.
Wow.
Impressive.
It was nuts. And I was flying back. And it was my first big talk. I was so nervous about it. I was speaking at the American Atheist Convention in Memphis, and I was flying back. I had a layover in Houston, and by the time I landed in Houston, it hit 1 million hits, and I'm sitting at the airport crying because 1 million people have never read anything that I've written. You know, it was my first professional piece, and I got back to LA, and we're sitting there hitting refresh on my Facebook page, and every minute we had another 100 followers. Like, it was nutty. And the next 2 weeks were just crazy watching the traffic. And I mean, since then, you know, I've done a lot of other things and I've had to, you know, write about things other than the Food Babe, obviously, because there are a lot of other things in pseudoscience that, you know, that we tackle at the page. And the big thing that I try to do is try to show people how to recognize reputable proof. And you know, while I was writing about, you know, before The Food Babe, I was working with a lit agent to try to, you know, try to sell a book. And the book that I wrote was Cy Babe's 10 Rules to BS Detection that I just turned in the manuscript for. So that's been the work I've been
doing.
Yeah, thank you. So that's been the work I've been doing. And that's the talk that I tend to give when people are like, can you come give a talk at our, you know, place of business? So that's the big thing I do is say, here's how you can tell, you know, in everyday life when you're, you know, wandering the internet or when you're at a store, if you see some weird overblown marketing claim, if something is for real or if it's just BS.
So give us some examples of your BS detection kit.
Okay. So my favorite rule that I have in there is I call it the Star Wars rule. We're amongst friends. We're all kind of nerds here. The Star Wars rule, if they tell you something is better because it's from a place far, far away and long, long ago, it's probably BS. And the way this rule became a thing, and I just posted this on my blog, recently, or on my Facebook page recently, they try to say that there is the most powerful antibiotic on the planet, and it's from medieval Europe. And the reason that it's good for you is because they made it in medieval Europe from a time and place when they got all sorts of plagues and infections. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with this picture? Come on. They died of all these infections. So that's really bad marketing, right? Like, I mean, some people are going to see that on the internet and they're going to go, oh, they use this during the time of the plague in some far off place. Of course it's good for me. No. Put your skeptic caps on. This is bad for you. And what worries me is that somebody who's trying to make, you know, a healthy decision for their family is going to fall for this. And, you know, they're not gullible. They're looking for something healthy and they're going to make a really horrible decision that's going to affect their health. So I figure put these rules that are kind of funny and kind of kitschy out there, and they're going to get people to think twice before they make a horrible decision.
So one thing I've definitely noticed in your writing, which I love, by the way, and we do post it on our own Facebook page quite a lot, actually, is that you're definitely going for a certain style. Mm. And now talking to you, it seems like that's just your personality, but it's not necessarily a put on style, but how much of it is conscious? I mean, how much do you try? Cause you know, there's always a little bit of vulgarity in there and a lot of popular references, which is, we're all good with that. But you know, how much of that is deliberate and how much is that just you being you?
I like to say there's a hair's width of difference. Like, I mean, I know I go home at the end of the day and I'm like, oh, I say I go home, but I do this from home. Like the sense of humor, it's all like, I can't turn it off. Trying to get me to stop swearing is like, I'm trying to think of a way to phrase it's like, I have to white knuckle through it when I'm told I can't swear before a talk. I went to Catholic school and I started swearing when I was 11. So yeah. Like that was not, it's just always been there. Like but combining it with science has been something, you know, a little different, a little goofy. I've been surprised to see how much it's resonated with people because, you know, I was an analytical chemist. I worked in a laboratory and I do know that this didn't always resonate with chemists who just wanted to get on with their jobs and were tired of somebody, you know, cracking jokes all the time. So, you know, time and a place, but it's been really wonderful, to see, you know, my personality resonating with people, at least on paper. So I'm sure that my ADHD riddled brain isn't everyone's cup of tea, but I'm glad that it's reaching people who are looking to you know, find some science in their day. And I think I'm not sure if it's the science that's resonating with people or if it's the humor, but I'm glad that they're at least getting some science with their laughter. So something I've noticed is, you know, when people get home at the end of the day, they're not reading academic papers. They're watching South Park. They're watching Penn and Teller's bullshit. You know, so I'm like, if people are getting something that's making them think, and they're getting it through a medium with something that makes them laugh, if I can make them laugh, they're going to get some science.
Yeah. It reminds me of those, I was talking to an old cranky professor and he was complaining that like these kids today, you know, they don't want to be taught. They want to be entertained. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, that's the reality. Just suck it up. You know, that's just, I think that's partly our culture is that we live in a multimedia culture, a fast paced culture, information. You know, we talked about this recently on the show that information transfer is very efficient And yeah, you can't give a slow plodding lecture anymore. It's just that people can't consume information that way. You have to keep up with the way people are consuming information.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I could sit there and complain about it, or I could meet people where they are. So, you know, let's meet people where they are. We can make it funny. We can throw a joke in there every paragraph, and it will keep people reading because they want to get to the next joke. And along the way, they're getting this misinformation debunked, and they're going to make better decisions because of it. And I'm like, this is wonderful. And I'm like, I feel like I finally found my little niche in the universe. And I just hope people, I hope people don't get tired of it. So as long as people are still reading, I'm going to keep throwing some good science out there.
Yeah, it's nice when, like, just doing what you naturally do finds an audience.
Yes, exactly.
I think is kind of what we fell into at the SGU. It's like, we're just doing what we do.
Yes, exactly.
People seem to like it, so we'll keep doing it. Yeah.
And the funny thing is, like, I had blogs before this just talking about my you know, stupid life that nobody cared about before except my friends. But, like, when I started, you know, writing, you know, doing funny writing about science, suddenly people cared about it. Because I think, you know, people always wanted to know how the universe works. People always wanted to know, you know, what was real and what wasn't. And I think people are always, like, here's the thing, the alternative health people always wanted to know what was real about their health. Like, that's why they're online Googling vaccines and Googling GMOs. They want to know what's safe to put into my body. They're desperately looking for what's true and what's not. They're desperate and they're vulnerable, and they're online hunting for whatever's fact and what isn't. And, you know, we have to find a way to get through to them. And I think humor is just a great tool. It's another tool in our arsenal. And it's like, I know some people, I'm not quite their style, and that's totally fine. I know that. I'm not changing for anyone, though. But the good thing is we have a lot of different communicators out there that are going to hit different people, and it's great.
Yeah, you can't be all things to all people, right?
Exactly.
That's right. Do what works for you, and, you know, that's probably where you're going to be your best in any case.
Yeah, that's kind of our general attitude of skepticism in general, Stevie, right? Because that's come up many times. Like, no, a skeptic should be this way. A skeptic should behave and believe this. It's like, well, no, find your niche and have fun at it, because you're going to stick with it if you enjoy it.
Right.
If you don't enjoy it, if you're forcing it, you're just not going to last.
Well, and it also takes all types, right? Like you just said, Yvette, there are certain people who need to get skeptical information who respond very well to, you know, one person's approach. And then there are other people who respond very well to somebody else's approach. It takes all types to cover the gamut.
Oh, yeah. And it's, I occasionally get somebody commenting on my page, I don't like what you're doing. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
Like, you know, what am I going to say to that? I'm like, I have a good following. It's always increasing. And like, I have a hard time keeping up with the requests for, you know, my writing on different websites. I'm like, yes, sir, I'm going to change what I'm doing for just you.
Yeah.
That's not how it's going to, and I'm like, I understand that I'm not the right source of information for everyone. And the funny thing is occasionally I'll have somebody say, could you take out the swears so that I can show this to my child?
Yeah, we get that too.
I'm like, no, that's not like, I'm like, and I understand that somebody might not want their kids to read my writing. I'm like, that's fine. Don't let your kids see it then. That's not my responsibility. But like,
so also part of your persona is that you're sort of unapologetically sexy, if I could just use that term.
Oh,
and
it's such, you know, a weird thing to use.
Well, I'm just trying to summarize quickly, but you're part of your, you know, you definitely are,
the babe
are
thing.
Very free, I think, to use that as part of your persona. You think that's fair?
Yeah, I'm a flirt. I won't back away from that.
So, do you get any pushback about that?
I have a couple times, and some people. Now, it started, the babe thing started as a as kind of a satire of the food babe. And I mean, I don't I don't think I post a lot of pictures going, here's my body, come look at it. And I mean, I use it as kind of a, you know, I'm going to science, and I'm going to write the way I want to, and I'm not going to apologize, and I'm going to woman the way that I want to, and I'm not going to apologize. And I have gotten some pushback, and a lot of people, at least in the science and skeptic community, did notice when Jerry Coyne, who I respect quite a bit, wrote a blog entry saying that I was being, I think the word he used was salacious, in my website.
Ooh, salacious.
And I mean, that was.
Kara's favorite Star Wars.
It was a little hurtful, I have to admit, especially because I respect Jerry so much, and I continue to respect the good work he does. And I've referred people to his book, Why Evolution is True, and I continue to do so if they have questions about evolution. And you know what? I still look at that and go, you know what? Science the way you want a science, skeptic the way you want a skeptic.
Yeah.
And I hope that, at some point he'll look at his words and think, you know what? Maybe I was wrong. Because the day before he posted that blog entry, he used my debunking, video on homeopathy on his blog. So yeah, I really hope that he'll take a second look at that, because he used me and another science blogger who I respect very much, who is anything but salacious. She's very respectful, if anything. And it was kind of, we were all kind of mortified when we saw ourselves being portrayed as salacious, to sell science, because I don't think that I use sex to sell it. I think I use humor and, you know, a lot of F-bombs.
Right,
but
right.
It seems odd that people look at that as how I portray myself, because I think I dress demurely when I'm in, you know, doing public speeches and all that good stuff. So I think that's not quite the mark, but, you know, flirty maybe, salacious no.
I remember that conversation very well with Jerry Coyne's blog article. And there were more than one person pointed out, because it did seem like he was saying, like, women science communicators can't look attractive without being accused of using sex to sell whatever their brand. And more than one person pointed out the double standard. Like, really? Do you think that Neil deGrasse Tyson doesn't look a little GQ? And you're telling me that he's not working it? You know, but no one's accusing him of, like, you know, being attractive as a way of enhancing his science communication, you know, reach or whatever. Which I thought, I hadn't thought about it, but when they pointed out, like, yeah, it's just absolutely true. Being just putting your best foot forward, it shouldn't be any kind of, you know, negativity about it at all, I think.
But it's, you know, there's always going to be that line of, you know, where's the line between attractive and looking sexy? And is, you know, where, you know, when is a woman not going to step foot in the public sphere without somebody questioning, is she too sexy? And I mean, I've never done a talk without, you know, being covered to my knees, I'm pretty sure.
Do you think that there's hope against the food babes of the world, or is there the message just too easily appealing?
Well, I think that the food babes of the world are always going to be there. They're never going to just disappear. We're always going to one of them's going to get out of pop culture circulation, and the next one's going to come right up. Rachel Parent is turning 18 any day now, and she's going to launch her own business. It's going to happen. And she's the kids' right to know person. She started activism at age 12, and she already has a TED talk. And wait for it, she's going to be Vanni Hari II. And wait for it, I'm also going to write about her eventually, but I'm not going to write about her while she's a kid. They're always, always going to be there. And the best that we can hope for, because they're always going to have their own little conventions, and they're always going to have conventions that only they speak at, and they're always going to be able to be very insular. The best we can hope for is to not let them on CNN and not let them onto mainstream networks. So, I mean, like right now, we have the best we can possibly hope for with Vanni Hari, because we can't get rid of her million followers. They're always going to follow her. Like, it's, you know, the people that just keep seeking out alternative health, we can try to convince them. Some people might not be convinced. They want to be convinced. So we can keep them out of the mainstream by really, really going hard in mainstream publications and saying, look, this is how it is, and not give the false balance that some scientists are speaking out. No, all scientists say this is BS, or a vast majority of scientists say this is BS, and really make it clear that this is not an acceptable way to, you know, to treat your illnesses, an acceptable way to present health claims by following someone like this. So I think that if we just keep on, you know, keep on communicating the truth and keep on not giving them a pulpit, we're eventually going to keep relegating them out to alternative health circles, and they're going to keep coming back, but we can keep pushing them down.
Yeah, I agree. It's an endless struggle. Yeah, the best we could do is marginalize them. In a way, I've thought, when I'm being optimistic, like the food babe is a good thing in that there's always, as you say, there's always going to be somebody in that slot. It might as well be somebody as stupid as her, who says things that are so easy to knock down. She's shooting fish in a barrel with her. Imagine if somebody like clever filled that niche.
That's a scary thought.
Yeah, it might be a little bit tricky. We'd still be able to take them down, but, you know, we'd have our work cut out for us.
I actually think that the Merkulas of the world are a little smarter than the Vani Haris of the world, because Vani, she shot a little too high. She thought she would take over mainstream. She underestimated how smart her opponents were. Mm-hmm. She thought, no one's ever going to catch on to this.
Yeah.
So, like, Merkulah just decided, no, I'm going to stay off to the side. I'm going to keep on doing everything on the side. I'm just going to have my website occasionally show up on the Dr. Oz show. Vani wanted a television show. She wanted everything. And she thought nobody would ever figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
Oops.
That's interesting perspective. Yeah. What's next on your agenda? Where are you taking your science communication? Are you happy where you are now?
I'm working on launching a podcast. It's taking a little bit to get it off the ground, but launching a podcast. It's going to be SciLife, with my co-host, comic Lauren Bancroft. And, other than that, just trying to keep on doing some good writing. My book is coming out probably end of this year-ish. I don't have a publication date on that yet, but those are the two biggies in my life. Keep on doing some good writing.
Awesome.
So thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, Yvette, thanks for coming on the show. It's great to have you. And we look forward to seeing you at Nexus. You are one of the speakers at Nexus. So
I look forward to seeing you guys too, as well.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. Is this the first theme this year for 2016?
Yeah, I think the last theme was a Christmas dinner or something.
Yeah.
It was just Christmas around the world.
The theme is the Zika virus. You guys hearing anything about the Zika virus?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
I haven't been reading up.
Let's see how much you've been paying attention to the
I've been reading headlines only.
This is a new kind of theme for science fiction where I'm, you know, ripping it from the headlines. We'll see if you guys are keeping up to date. So you ready for this?
Okay. Two of us aren't.
All right. Item number one. The virus has spread from continent to continent, hitching a ride on mosquitoes that in turn were spread by shipping. Item number two, although the virus is primarily spread through mosquitoes, there is evidence for possible transmission through donated blood, sexual contact, and from mother to infant. And item number three, the virus was first isolated from a rhesus monkey in the Zika forest in Uganda. Kara, go first.
Okay. Spread from continent to continent, hitching a ride on mosquitoes that in turn were spread by shipping. Sounds reasonable. Why not? I don't think mosquitoes fly from continent to continent all by their lonesome. They'd probably die. But I guess they could bite like a bird or something else that goes from continent to continent. I think we're better at getting from continent to continent, though, than any organism that might have the virus. Although the virus is primarily spread through mosquitoes, there is evidence for possible transmission through donated blood, sexual contact, and from mother to infant. I would not be surprised by that. Most viruses, I shouldn't say most, but a lot of viruses can be spread through some sort of physical contact, whether it's through saliva or blood or something like that. And the virus was first isolated from a rhesus monkey in the Zika forest in Uganda. I feel horrible that I don't know if this is true or not, but I thought Zika was like a South American virus, as opposed to what we often think of these African origin viruses. So just off the top of my head, I'm going to say that it's fiction that it came from Uganda.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, I just lightly read one article on this, and I remember thinking, why isn't it telling me where this is happening? It just wasn't saying where we were talking, what they were talking about in terms of location. So that's – I don't remember a hell of a lot more. So the continent-to-continent shipping, sure, seems reasonable. The Zika forest one in Uganda, you know, I think I when I read the article, I think I read exactly where it was from. And, of course, I have no memory of it at all. So that could very well be true.
It's 'cause, like, who cares?
I just don't remember it being – I don't remember any mention of it being anything other than mosquitoes. Possibly mosquitoes got it from other little creatures, but I don't remember anything about donated blood, sexual contact, or mother infant. So on that alone, I guess I'm going to have to say that one was – that's the fiction.
Okay. And Evan.
Hitching a ride on mosquitoes, okay. That in turn were spread by shipping. Okay. I don't have a problem with that one. I don't know why I might feel that that one's the fiction, though. Or I think it's the second one. Yeah. Which is evidence for possible transmission through donated blood, sexual contact, and from mother to infant. Oh, crumbs. I'll say that, bred by shipping. Yeah, I don't think it's spread by shipping. I'll say that that one's the fiction. It's a person-born transmission, not the mosquitoes themselves traveling around it. They hit the people, and then the people start spreading it. So
okay, so you guys all spread out, 1, 2, and 3.
That's weird. Does that ever happen?
It happens occasionally, but
only when Jay's not here. Because there's only three choices.
So since there's three choices and you chose each one, I'll take them in order.
Oh gosh.
The virus
you stand alone.
The virus has spread from continent to continent, hitching a ride on mosquitoes that in turn were spread by shipping. Evan thinks this one is the fiction. Bob and Kara think this one is science. And this one is the fiction.
Oh,
it is. Holy crap.
Congratulations, Evan.
Oh, did I snip it out?
And you got it exactly correct. That the virus is spreading from continent to continent because people are getting infected and they're traveling, and then a mosquito bites them in their new location and then starts to spread it there. So the virus is traveling with the people, not with the mosquitoes.
People are the vectors.
I should have known this. I've been traveling so much, and there are signs at every airport about Zika.
So let me give some background on the virus before we go on to 2 and 3. This has been in the news recently. I blogged about this yesterday, guys. Did anyone read about it? Read my blog?
I saw that you blogged about it, but I didn't read the blog.
So the Zika virus is a flavivirus. It's flaviviridae, an arbovirus. Flavivirus. It's an arbovirus, which is in the same family as dengue fever or yellow fever, also spread by mosquitoes. It is spread by a type of mosquito that actually was spread around the world through shipping and is an invasive species. So the virus is more of a problem because we have previously spread this mosquito around the world. It's everywhere in the Americas except for Canada and Chile for some reason. So Canada is safe, but it's in the United States. It's everywhere in the United States. In the U.S., you know, we are more concerned with things like West Nile virus, you know, similar kind of spread, mosquito-borne virus. This is actually a very mild infection. You get fever, rash, joint pain, and conjunctivitis. 75% or 3 out of 4 people who are infected have a subclinical infection, meaning that the symptoms are so mild they don't even know that they're infected. That's good and bad. It means that it's a very mild infection, but it also means you could be sick and not know it, and you could be a vector. You could be transporting that virus around the world. And you can't use fever or symptoms as a reliable way of knowing who's carrying the virus because, you know, you could have it without having any symptoms. However, and this is preliminary, which is partly why I didn't talk about this. This is also what's been in the news. The reason why we're getting concerned about the Zika virus, well, two things. One, it's becoming a real epidemic, not just this, you know, low-grade infection. And two is because there has been a huge spike in children being born with microcephaly, which means small head.
I did see those photos.
Yeah.
A lot of photos.
Which is due to poor brain development. And the preliminary evidence suggests that this is a complication of pregnant women getting sick with the virus. And it's causing developmental disorders, specifically microcephaly. So that's really serious.
Yeah.
The World Health Organization and the CDC are advising women who might be pregnant, not to travel to areas where the virus is having an epidemic. In those areas, like Brazil, et cetera, are advising mothers to think about delaying getting pregnant until this is over, like by a year or two. Like, don't get pregnant now while the virus is spreading. There's no treatment. There's no vaccine. The only way to really contain it is to contain the spread. You have to protect individuals from mosquitoes, and you have to try to reduce the mosquito population by getting rid of standing water, spraying, etc. This is a serious illness that is suddenly getting a lot of attention, and it deserves a lot of attention. The only cases in the United States so far are cases where people picked it up from another country and then they traveled back to the U.S. But again, that's a way to get the virus into the mosquito population in the U.S., and then you can have an outbreak here. Let's go on to 2 and 3, then we'll finish talking about the virus. So 2, although the virus is primarily spread through mosquitoes, there is evidence for possible transmission through donated blood, sexual contact, and from mother to infant. That is true. That is science. There's a case report. I said possible transmission, not confirmed transmission. There is a case report of a man who had the virus and started to develop symptoms in his penis, and his sperm had very high counts of the virus, enough that it's possible that he could have transmitted it through sexual contact. There have been detected the Zika virus in donated blood, and the concern there is, again, people are not sick. So they're donating blood. They're not sick. They don't realize that they're not supposed to donate blood. The only, you can test the blood with PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, to see if it has the virus in it. So they're recommending that blood be screened, for the virus. There are documented cases of actual transmission from mother to infants. So that has been confirmed. Again, as you said, Kara, not surprising.
Not surprising.
Viruses get in fluids, they spread around. But the primary vector is mosquito. I'll mention at this point that we do not know if there is a non-human reservoir. It's basically unknown at this point. That's critical, because if the virus does not have a non-human reservoir, a place where it lives when it's not infecting humans, we could potentially eradicate it. If there are non-human reservoirs, we really can't.
But how would that work? Somebody has a subclinical infection, it mutates, and it becomes something that's a little more dangerous? I don't know. I guess there are viruses that don't spill over from other animals, but then they must mutate in the human population just over time.
Well, both can happen. They could jump species. They could become more virulent, within humans, or they are simultaneously infecting multiple species. And even if we tamp it down in humans, it's still living in whatever, deer, monkeys, whatever. And then
it just seems weird to me that there wouldn't be some sort of population of animals somewhere that has a related virus.
Oh, it might be related virus, but it may not be able to infect humans. The question is, does the virus that can infect humans also currently able to infect other animals, or has it basically just specialized on humans and now it can't infect anyone else? All right, let's go on. Number 3, the virus was first isolated from a rhesus monkey in the Zika forest in Uganda. That is science. It did start in Africa, and that was in 1950s. It was actually 1947 that it was first isolated from a rhesus monkey, but then the first infection in a human was documented in 1952. But it stayed in Africa as a low-grade infection nobody worried about for a long time. It then jumped to Asia, and now since around 2007 to South America, and now it's exploding in South America. That's where the real epidemic is happening right now, but it did originate in Africa.
That's the one you were baiting us with.
Yeah. So it was called a slow pandemic, but now it's not so slow. It's now, getting fast. It's a fast pandemic. Something to keep an eye on. As I say, it's when I wrote about it, I made the point that we're always in this delicate position where it's like, we want to make the public aware of these potential threats, these infectious diseases, without overhyping it or fear mongering. When the worst case scenario does not manifest, and there's always people saying, oh, they overhyped it or whatever. The bird flu or swine flu, these things have not so far materialized as a serious threat. But I say, but what about HIV? That came out of nowhere. That was a new virus that jumped species to humans and then became a virulent virus. And now it's a chronic illness that has literally changed the practice of medicine. It's hard to think of now, the days before HIV. The same thing can happen. What about the 1918 super flu that killed 20 to 40 million people worldwide? That can happen again. And in fact, we're more susceptible because of the density of air travel, that we're spreading organisms all over the world.
Yeah, it blows people's minds. I find that this is I see deniers of this all the time when you talk about the flu being a huge killer. People are like, the flu doesn't kill people.
Sure.
And seriously? It's really dangerous.
Yeah, it kills 10 to 30,000 people in the U.S. alone every year.
In the U.S. alone. Yeah. But we don't think about it because we're like, I had the flu once and I didn't die.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, it could get bad again. And we do have to be mindful of that.
Yeah. Again, the point I made was, these critters, viruses, bacteria, they evolve. Change mm-hmm. is their primary adaptation. And they will evolve. They will get more virulent. It's just a matter of time. It's going to happen. And it's the job of the World Health Organization and the CDC and similar organizations to keep an eye on that, to anticipate the worst, and to try to do things to mitigate it, to minimize it. So, you know, we do need to take these things seriously. At this point, for the Zika virus, the big thing is just the mosquito control. That is, I think, the big issue, is to take measures to prevent being bitten by mosquitoes and to prevent, you know, the overpopulation of mosquitoes. What's interesting is that somebody brought up in the comments to my blog that there's scientists seriously considering the possibility of this very interesting question. What if we completely eliminated mosquitoes from the world? Are they a necessary organism?
I ask my friends that all the time because I hate those little jerks.
Or would we be fine? Would there be unintended consequences? Would we be fine without mosquitoes? Do we, you know, things would adapt? Yeah, things eat. And the point that there was a paper actually that said that, well, there are species like bats, et cetera, that eat mosquitoes. It's actually a minority of their diet. If you actually do like stomach content analysis, there are insect food, mosquitoes are actually not, they don't have a lot of meat on their bones, I guess, on their exoskeleton or inside their exoskeleton. So they just don't contribute a lot of protein, of total mass to the diet of creatures that eat insects. And so they would probably adapt just fine.
You know, but they are, I mean, they're, it's minor, but aren't they pollinators also?
Yeah. But as you say, it's minor. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm not advocating this, and I'm not saying it's been thoroughly explored, but the question has been raised. Would there be any negative consequences if we did have the technology to eradicate mosquitoes?
Well, we're getting to the point where we do.
You talked about this recently. Yeah. That, you know, with the genetically modified mosquitoes that could mm-hmm. pretty effectively wipe out, you know, mosquito populations. We may be able to actually pull that off. So it might not be just a hypothetical question in the not too distant future. Before we go to the quote, Evan, we do have an announcement. This is a follow-up. The last week, we talked about the fact that Nexus is now open for registration, which it is. And we will all be there. The SU will be there. Yvette, who is on the show this week, is going to be there giving a talk. One of the speakers that we announced last week was Richard Dawkins. And unfortunately, the Nexus did decide to rescind our invitation to Richard Dawkins to speak at the conference. This was not a decision that we took lightly. There was a lot of hand-wringing and rigorous discussion about what is a very complicated issue. Because the issue is still evolving, I'm just going to refer you to a blog post on my blog Neurologica called Nexus and Richard Dawkins. We'll provide a link to that in the notes. That goes over it in quite some detail. There's a active discussion following. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to be said about this. It is unfortunately turning into, you know, quite the controversy, but we will keep you updated as things change. Evan, give us the quote of the week.
I have a question for you all, and I'm going to phrase it in the form of a quote. What's the difference between an invisible, incorporeal, floating dragon who spits heatless fire and no dragon at all? And that was posed by Carl Sagan in his wonderful book, The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark, coming from the chapter in his book called The Dragon in My Garage, in which what he is essentially saying is that if you're going to make a claim and you have no evidence to back up your claim, then what is the difference between that and the claim not existing from the beginning at all?
Now, Evan, I'm going to use your quote as an opportunity to do an impromptu name that logical fallacy.
Ooh.
So okay. What is the logical fallacy that Carl Sagan is describing there?
Which fallacy?
Yep, that's the question. Which logical fallacy?
That is the question.
I didn't think of it. I didn't think of it in the context of a defined.
It's a
fallacy.
Very specific logical fallacy.
Anyone? Wait, give me a minute. Give me a minute.
Yeah, I'm going through. I have a list in my head.
I know.
It's like a Chinese menu. I have to check off each one or cross it out as I don't.
So look at it the other way. You know, and Sagan goes through this example in his book. You say, somebody says they have a dragon in your garage. Like, great, let me take a look. Well, I don't see a dragon.
Moving the goalpost.
Close. I don't see a dragon. Well, that's because he's invisible. Oh, well, I'll feel for him. Well,
he's special incorporeal. Pleading?
Special pleading. It's special pleading. which is an informal logical fallacy. Now, the thing about special pleading that's interesting is that each individual point that you make in order to explain away the lack of evidence may be reasonable unto itself. But the point is, it's post hoc reasoning. You're inventing that reason without its own evidence in order to explain away the lack of evidence. And the more times you have to do that, the less likely your hypothesis becomes. So you get to the point, and Carl Sagan was saying special pleading, the end result of that, it merges on there being no difference between your claim and not existing at all, right? Well, you've special pleaded away all of the existence of your claim. Now, this comes up quite frequently in the real world. You know, this is a fanciful example that Sagan's giving, but one of my favorite examples from medicine is chronic Lyme disease. So there are those who think that people have a chronic active infection with the Lyme spirochete. And of course, there's no scientific evidence to support that conclusion. And you say, okay, if you think this patient has chronic Lyme, why don't they have the typical symptoms of chronic CNS or nervous system Lyme disease? And they say, well, that's because it's an atypical infection. Okay, why are their blood tests negative? Well, that's because they have seronegative Lyme. Okay, well, how come the antibiotics don't eradicate the spirochete? Because they have treatment-resistant, you know, version of the spirochete. So you're telling me that they have treatment-resistant, seronegative, atypical Lyme disease. And it's the same exact thing. What's the difference between that and not having Lyme disease? What's the difference between that and no dragon at all? It's the exact, it's their special pleading away all of the criticisms of their lack of evidence for their position. And then, of course, you can go even further. Well, how come the studies show that treating people who think they have chronic Lyme disease with antibiotics in a blinded, you know, clinical trial doesn't work? Well, that's because they didn't study it correctly or whatever. You know, they'll come up with some additional special pleading. Nothing will kill the claim. It becomes unfalsifiable. So special pleading is a logical fallacy when you use it as a post hoc way of rendering your claim immune to refutation. And that's exactly what Carl Sagan was talking about. So great quote. Great quote, Evan.
Yeah. I mean, I'm surprised we hadn't touched on it before, but it's
classic.
It's one of my favorite chapters and one of my favorite books.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Thank you.
Sure, Steve.
Thank you, Doctor.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.